The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler, and on this week's edition of Lifetime Income, Dr. David Bush is our guest. He is Doctor of Radiation Oncology at Loma Linda University, and we'll be discussing the expansion of the use of proton beam therapy, which has a lot of implications for people who are retired, believe it or not. Last week, we focused our efforts on the program on tax planning. And what we examined were the three different tax brackets investors need to be more aware of, which impacts not only what you pay on what you earn, but also the additional Obamacare tax brackets, where you lose your itemized deduction exemptions and pay additional taxes on your investment income. So what we're going to do on today's program is focus on saving taxes on your investment income. You need to understand the tax laws have become much more progressive under President Obama. We already discussed last week the new set of stealth taxes that were put into place under Obamacare. So what we want to do today is to illustrate how using tax preference investing can really make a difference in how much you finally end up with at retirement time and the lifestyle you'll be able to afford. So, Jim, if we could, let's do a recap on the tax brackets again, since they really determine how you should be constructing your investment portfolio.
You know, one of the reasons that we spend so much time on this number, it is really the brackets that determine, John, the number of how you should be invested. And that is a number that every investor should be aware of. Now, you need to not only know your marginal tax bracket, both at the federal level, but also the state level, for those of you that live in states that have an income tax bracket, and especially in states now, which is more important. A lot of states during the last downturn raised their income taxes, California being one of them. But also under Obamacare, you also have investment tax brackets that can increase depending on your income. So let's just start out once again. I'm going to talk about three kinds of taxpayers. If you're single, if you're married, or your head of household. Now, I'm assuming most people that listen to this program are going to be in a higher tax bracket. So I'm going to start out with the 25% tax bracket. We'll skip the 15% and 10% bracket. If you're in those brackets, you don't need to be listening to this show because this probably doesn't apply. The 25% bracket starts at $37,650 if you're single, $75,300 if you're married, and $50,400 if you're head of household. The 28% bracket starts at $91,150 if you're single, $151,900 if you are married, and $130,150 if you're head of household. And one of the reasons that we're covering head of household, there are a lot of single parents today that are head of household taking care of kids. From 28%, we jump a full 5 percentage points, which is the next tax bracket. It's $190,150. That's the 33% bracket for singles, $231,450 for married, and $210,800 if you're head of household. The 35% bracket starts at $413,350 and basically starts at $413,000 at married couple and head of household. So the 35% bracket is the same for single, married, and head of household. They figure when you make that money, we're going to get you. The 39.6% bracket starts at $415,050 if you're single, $466,950 if you're married, and $441,000 if you are head of household. Now, we talked about last week, it's not the 39.6, believe it or not, The brackets go all the way up to 44%, and that's because they phase out your itemized deductions, phase out your exemptions, and then there's the Obamacare tax. So let me just cover those briefly. The phase out of starting for itemized deductions, where they take 3% of your adjusted gross, that is $259,400 if you are a single taxpayer, $311,300 if you are married, and a household is $285,350. Now, for a lot of you that have, you pay state taxes, which is an itemized deduction. You have mortgage interest on your home. That's an itemized deduction. You have miscellaneous deductions, charitable deductions. You start to begin to lose those once you get in over these higher brackets. Once you reach that level, they basically take 3% of your adjusted gross income. Remember, that's the bottom line figure on the front page of your tax return. That's why that is important. So this number is frozen. Now, the next number, and this could be significant for those of you that are married and they have a couple children or you're head of household, the personal exemption is $4,050. It actually went up $50 this year. They begin to phase that out. If you are single and your income is $259,400, they phase it out completely by the time you get to $381,900. If you're married, it begins at $311,300, and by $433,800, you don't get any exemptions at all. And this is becoming, John, very, very important, not only with the tax laws that they just changed Social Security last November, but this is also becoming very important in divorce cases. So we're going to do a special case on going through divorce, because this is going to change some of the negotiations. Because let's take a husband and wife. Let's say you get divorced. The husband was the main breadwinner, and he's making over this amount. It is really important when you negotiate that you negotiate those exemptions for you. Let's say you're the wife in this case, where you could use those exemptions because, say, for example, you get one for yourself, and let's say you have two kids, there's $12,000 worth of deductions that you don't want to, you know, just give away. Likewise, for a head of household, $285,350 to $407,850.
You know, Jim, we talk about all of the changes that have been made. I'm really wondering if they thought of the implications regarding file and suspend, file and restrict, all of these other things when you combine it with your tax situation.
No, they really didn't. And I think this is going to be a big issue in upcoming divorces on the file suspend issue. We'll get into that. We're actually going to do a couple shows on going through a divorce, because as we did a case study just before Christmas on a client who finally retired at age 70, went through a divorce and found out he had Parkinson's disease. But, you know, going through that divorce changed some of the outcome of his retirement. And this is going to change a lot of the negotiations going forward. So anyway, I wanted to get that exemption phase out. Now, I know you're probably saying, gosh, there's enough brackets. Well, there's actually two more brackets that you need to be aware of. And this is how complex this has become. There's also the Obama investment tax bracket, and this does not get indexed by inflation. If you're single and you make $200,000, you can add an additional 3.8% to your capital gains and all of your investment income. If you're married, it's $250,000. Then the other thing is, if you're single and you have $415,000, you move into the 20% capital gains tax bracket. And if you are married, it's $466,950. And if you're head of household, $441,000, you move in to that higher capital gains bracket. It goes from 15% to 20%. And then on top of that, throw the additional 3.8% Medicare tax. And then on top of that, John, we've got to talk about state taxes, which can be added on that. So taxes on investments income is the highest bracket now, is 23.8%. That's on the federal side. And on capital gains, it can go from 0 to 20%. and add to that your state tax bracket if you live in a state that has an income tax. So you can see the four, let me see, what did I do? One, two, three, four different tax brackets you need to be aware of as an investor. So the top federal bracket, when you phase out the deductions, phase out the exemptions, add the additional Medicare tax of 0.9% plus the 1.45%, you can go as high as 44.3% on the federal side, and then whatever bracket you're in at your state. So you can see where this can really add up very quickly in taking a lot of that investment income that you earn, which is why you need to know what these numbers are.
Yeah, the tax brackets are really important. I had a friend of mine just reflect that he had just jumped into the next tax bracket, and it really cost him substantially more in tax, so much so that he actually lost money on the whole deal. So it shows you how really our tax system, Jim, is goofy, but it is what it is. And we really need to reform it, not just by reformation, but probably just throwing it in the trash and coming up with a simple system. But I don't think our politicos are going to want it. Nevertheless, you have to deal with the tax brackets as they are and to follow along with the discussion today. But you can see how, depending on your income, how progressive tax rates can wreak havoc on your investment income. And that's why it's important to incorporate them in your planning. So let's move on to tax planning.
Well, the first thing we want to discuss today was, as we mentioned here, we just went through the marginal tax bracket. Now, why knowing this number is important is you don't want to have taxable investment interest or short-term capital gains if you're in a high tax bracket, because the tax rates can get as high as 57%. And I'm counting my own state of California. If you live in a high tax state like California, New York, Hawaii, New Jersey, Oregon, for example, you could end up on top of the federal bracket giving away double digits to the governor of your state for your state bracket. For example, let me bring this home of how devastating this can be. Let's say that you have a $10,000 short-term capital gain. You live in California. So it's a short-term capital gain. It's taxed as ordinary income. You're in the top tax bracket federal, which is 44%. And you're in the top tax bracket in the state of California, which is 13.3%. So on that $10,000 of short-term capital gain, you would owe $4,400 in federal taxes and $1,330 to the state of California. So on a $10,000 profit, you would owe the government $5,730. You would only keep a little over $4,000 of that $10,000 gain. So you can see why a high tax bracket investor should not do a lot of trading, unless you're doing that in a pension plan where there's no taxes, or take short-term capital gains. The Fed and state taxes, literally, John, are getting to the point of what some would consider confiscation.
You know, as bad as those numbers sound, Jim, it could actually get much worse. I don't know if you've been watching the presidential debates that have been going on. And depending on the outcome of the presidential elections, first of all, at the primary level and then at the national level, Secretary Clinton wants a 5% surtax on income, a wealth tax on total net worth, and to raise capital gains taxes to 28%. Now, you have to recognize that there are retired people making a living off of some of the stuff that they're proposing to tax in the name of punishing Wall Street. But that 28% capital gains rate rise is a mistake that President Clinton, her husband, made in his first term of office, if you remember, because what he did is he later reduced the capital gains back to 20% because they discovered the horrible detrimental effect it had on the markets. Now, as bad as those proposals are, Senator Sanders' ideas are worse. He wants 90% tax rates and to cap income at $1 million. Anything over that, a 100% tax rate. So you can make more, but the government's going to take it all. So as bad as things are right now, they could get progressively worse if the Democrats take over the White House and possibly take back control of Congress. That's how we got Obamacare, which I think we're going to see start to unravel here because of its own unsustainability. And the Obamacare tax brackets that phase out your itemized deductions and exemptions and raise the tax on your investments. So we know if you're a high tax bracket, you don't want ordinary taxable investment income. So what are the investment choices that are left after all of this?
Well, believe it or not, we still have four or five things that you can do. I mean, we discussed last week briefly that there are numerous choices here that are available depending basically on your investment tolerance for risk and your need for income, because everybody's a little different. So you can't make a blanket statement that, well, if you're in a certain tax bracket, you should have X amount of dollars in tax freeze. You know, maybe you have a higher risk tolerance, so something else would be more appropriate, or you may have a lot of bucks, but you're saying, you know what, at my age, given my net worth, I don't want to take a lot of risk. So everybody is a little different. So that's why I want to talk about all four of these, and we're going to cover them. The four choices you have are tax-free investing, like municipal bonds, tax-deferred investing, think of pensions, your 401k, SEP IRAs, Roth IRAs, annuities. You have what is called tax-sheltered investing, which you can get through real estate, oil and gas, or immediate annuities. And then there's something called tax preference investing, and those are dividends and capital gains, because dividends are taxed at 15 to 20% versus the higher ordinary income tax rates, depending on where your brackets fall. And then also the difference on capital gains. Capital gains can go from 15 to 20% depending on your income. So there's four different ways that you can use to reduce your taxable income, because you really, when you think about it, take your salary or your pension, remove your itemized deductions and exemptions. That's your marginal tax bracket. So that means any investment income that comes in can be taxed at that higher bracket. And that's why you want to make sure that you are investing in the most tax favorable way possible, because it's not so much what you make, it's what you keep that counts the most. So we usually use a combination of strategies to reduce taxable income. You don't want to use just one approach. But, you know, I have one of my largest clients, the bulk of his assets, almost 65, 70% of his assets are in tax-free bonds, because he was very successful, sold his company, and basically paid a fortune in taxes, both to the state of California and to the federal government. And he basically said, you know, that's it. I paid high taxes all my life. I don't want to do that again. And so that's the way he likes it. And he has enough assets where he can afford to be in a low-risk category and just collect tax-free checks.
Okay, why don't we begin with tax-free investing, since you were mentioning it here. That seems to be the most important, since tax-free bonds are actually double tax-free.
Well, for investors who live in high tax states, California being one of them, and New York is another I can think of, or even Hawaii, where tax brackets can get as high as 13%, like my own state of California, where they're 13.3. An example would be, let's take a California tax-free bond. Right now, a 10-year treasury yields roughly just slightly under 1.9%. By comparison, a California high-quality tax-free bond yields close to 2%. So the, believe it or not, John, for most of my career, municipal bonds always yielded less than taxable bonds because they were tax-free. But that changed with quantitative easing, where central banks pushed down the yields on sovereign debt. So today you have a situation where actually the yield on a tax-free bond, I mean, you may even want a muni because it pays more interest than what you can get in, let's say, a sovereign bond. So California pays about 2%. So it's a slightly higher yield, but more importantly, you would pay no federal or state taxes. Now, you do not pay state taxes on, let's say, the interest from a treasury. You would pay federal tax, but you wouldn't pay state taxes. So you don't have to worry about that. So that 2% yield on municipals is equivalent to a pre-tax yield of 4%. And if you live in my own state like California, 2% double tax free, you would have to earn almost 4.7% to have the same rate after taxes. So that's why you need to know what your tax bracket is before you invest, because a lot of people are invested, John, in CDs, taxable investments, and they're getting clobbered without realizing it on their federal and state taxes.
Okay, option number one, we've just talked about it here, is tax-free investing. Let's move on to option number two, and that is tax-deferred investing. Now, the obvious option here is putting money into a pension plan where you get a tax deduction for the contribution, and your investment grows on a tax-deferred basis.
Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time here other than to say that if you aren't using a pension plan, you are making a grave, grave mistake regarding any retirement planning. And in fact, it's probably one of the biggest mistakes made in retirement planning besides choosing the wrong Social Security options. But, you know, here's the advantage. If you're putting money in a 401k, 403b, 457 plan, depending on where you work, you're getting three benefits. One, the money you put in the plan, you get a tax deduction for it. You don't pay any income, so you're saving income taxes. Two, many employers, in fact, most employers today make a matching contribution. Some will match 100%, some will match a portion of it. So you're missing out on the contributions your own employer is making towards your retirement. And number three, your investments, whether you're in stocks, bonds, whatever it is you're investing in, they're tax deferred. So you don't have to include that in your taxable return. Now, let me give you an example, and this is going to shock you to drive home this point. Let's say you are putting $500 a month into a 401k plan. So $500 a month, 12 months a year, that's $6,000. Let's assume that you're in a plan where your employer matches you dollar for dollar on the first 6% of your income, which a lot of companies do today. So in addition to your $6,000, your employer is putting in $6,000. Now, the $6,000 that you're putting into that plan, you are saving $2,100 in taxes. And I'm using a combined tax rate roughly about 30%. So that $6,000 you're putting in to that plan is equivalent to $14,100. The $2,100 you're saving on your personal taxes, the $6,000 matching contribution from your employer. Now, let's throw some numbers out. Let's just assume, let's be conservative and say over a working career, you're going to earn 6%. I know a lot of people in our business are using the 10% returns in the stock market over the last 100 years, but given where markets are, given where interest rates are, and given financial repression, we're going to use something a little bit more conservative, assuming a 6%. So that $14,000 at 6% over 20 years would grow to almost $519,000 and over 30 years to $1.1 million. It's actually a little more than that, but I'm rounding it off. $1.1 million. Now, let me dramatize that. Let's assume the same $6,000, but this time you're paying 35% tax rates, federal and state. That means the $6,000, you only have $3,900 afterwards. And because you're going to be in higher tax rates for your investments, you're only earning a 4% return instead of a 6% return. Over 20 years, your $3,900 would grow to $115,000 versus the $519,000 in over 30 years, you would only have $215,000 versus the $1.1 million. So if there's one thing I'm driving home today that I want to get across to you, is tax-efficient investing can make all the difference in the world in terms of the kind of lifestyle that you're going to enjoy and life you're going to live during retirement. And so that's why we want to kind of pick up on last week's subject, because it's one of the big mistakes that we see people make, and especially after the financial crisis, is a lot of people are investing tax inefficiently, and it's harming their well-being when you consider the long-term effects of taxes in terms of having less money to spend, less money to save.
Well, not using a pension plan, Jim, as you said, is a major mistake when a lot of people make when planning for retirement. The tax deduction, the tax deferral, and employer matching is a real powerful combination to build towards retirement. Okay, let's move on to tax-sheltered investing as the next strategy we have here to reduce taxable income.
You know, there's probably a couple areas that you can get this. The one I'm going to bring up that is most common is real estate. You buy a piece of real estate, you know, it's an apartment, it's a condo, it's a commercial building. What you can do is deduct the interest that you have to pay on that investment. That becomes a business deduction, but you also get depreciation on that building. So let me just make this easy. Let's say you bought a $3 million office building. You depreciated over 30 years. It's actually 25, but let's just say 30. You would get $100,000 a year in depreciation, which you could use that $100,000 to offset rental income. So it's one of the ways, you know, Donald Trump has gotten to be a billionaire, speaking of billionaires, because he's able to shelter it. The same thing that Warren Buffett has done. Warren has not only been a shrewd investor, but he's only paid, you know, 15% and 20% tax rates because the majority of his income, $59 million last year, was taxed at the dividend tax rate and the capital gains rate, just like Donald Trump saves probably $100 million a year in taxes just on the depreciation he gets from all his real estate. Another form of tax advantage investing are master limited partnerships, which are listed on the stock exchange. A lot of these are energy companies, pipeline companies. Now, here's the good news. You can get yields of up to 6 to 7% with 70 to 100% of that dividend tax sheltered. Now, here's the disadvantage. And let me just make a simple illustration. Let's suppose you make a $10,000 investment, and we'll just simplify and say you got $1,000 in dividends on that investment. And all that dividend is tax sheltered. What happens is you wouldn't pay any tax on that $1,000 dividend, but it reduces your cost basis in the stock from $10,000 to $9,000. So if you sell it down the road, you can pay capital gains. And actually, there's a way through estate planning to remove that tax altogether. But these are two examples, John, where tax-sheltered investing, you know, the depreciation you get on real estate and the depreciation you get like on pipelines and energy can shelter a dividend from taxation.
And finally, we come to tax preference investing. That's interesting.
Tax preference investing basically is dividend stocks. I mean, dividends are taxed at a rate of 15 to 20%. And if you're a real, real, real low tax bracket, you probably pay less than 10%. So dividends are taxed at 15 to 20% for the majority of Americans in this country. They're going to pay 15% tax on dividends. And if it is a long-term capital gain, you're going to pay only 15% or 20%. Not excluding that Obama investment tax. So this is why, John, I think it's really important that, you know, you use a number of combinations. You know, most individuals, if you're making a halfway decent income, your household of two or both a husband and wife are working, you're probably in a 30 to 35% tax bracket, counting your federal and state. And, you know, when you get into that 35, 40% tax bracket, they're taking a big chunk of your investment income. Why not make it tax-free, tax-sheltered, or tax-deferred and save that money and put it in your own pocket for savings for retirement rather than giving it away to the government, which spends it inefficiently?
Okay, so what we have here now, everything we've discussed, first of all, it's important that you know the tax brackets and how they're going to affect you, and then the taxable options on some investments. First of all, there's tax-free, tax-deferred, tax-sheltered, and tax-preference, and they all have advantages which you need to plan on. Well, here we go. It's time to do our case study. These case studies, which we do on Lifetime Income every single week, are based on real people and real circumstances. We simply change the names to protect the privacy of the people. So let's frame the people and the issue, Jim.
This is the case of Tom and Maggie Parker, both of them, same age, 54. Their plan was to retire at age 60. Now, Tom earns $175,000. Maggie earns $106,000. They're both fortunate enough that they will have pensions at retirement that'll produce a combined income of $120,000 a year starting at age 60. Now, the current plan is to move from a high-tax state like California to move to retirement, where they also have family there. They want to move to Florida. Smart move. You get rid of, I mean, anybody that lives in California, you're basically in a 9.3% state tax bracket. So you add their brackets of probably closer to 33%. You add 9 California, they're over 40%. They're currently saving $60,000 into 401k plans. No real taxable savings. $24,000 per year saved in a Roth 401k. Investable assets are $1.4 million in a home that's paid off and worth roughly about $500,000. One of the reasons they got the amount of assets they have, they live simply and they are great savers. They lived very simply. They live in an area of California inland where the properties are much, much cheaper. Anything along the coast in California, and you're talking about $1 million plus. So the idea was when they reach age 60, get out of California, go to Florida, get rid of that 9.3% state tax bracket plus your money, buys a real nice place in Florida. And the idea is spend roughly about, they're looking in the areas they're looking at would be somewhere around $300,000. Their annual living expenses now and in retirement would be roughly about $90,000. We do not use the Roth option on the 401k. Currently, they are in a 33% bracket and are projected to be roughly in a 25% bracket in retirement. That's mainly coming from their pensions of $120,000 a year. Starting at age 60, we will begin to maximize Roth conversions without bumping them up into a high tax bracket, which is why we wanted to stop it now. Tom is going to take a 75% survivor option on his pension when he retires. That'll be $74,000 a year. Maggie is only going to take a 25% survivor option, which will be $41,000. The reason being is longevity runs in her family, and typically women outlive men in retirement. So longevity is going on Maggie's side. Now, they're going to continue to maximize their health savings account because that's a tax deduction for the contributions, and it can be used for medical cost in retirement, and it's tax-free when you use it to pay for medical expenses. This is also important since they have to basically buy their own coverage from age 60 to 65 because until they can get on Medicare, they're going to have to buy their own health insurance, and so the health savings accounts will be tax-free if they need to use that to pay for any medical expenses. The after-tax savings were investing in a muni bond portfolio and blue-chip stocks, more heavily weighted more towards municipal bonds because at some point they're going to have to start taking IRA distributions down the road as their IRAs accumulate and they roll over their 401k plans into an IRA when they retire. We did remove the MLP exposure in the IRAs since that can trigger something called unrelated business taxable income. That's a topic for a whole nother show. And also, we're using tax inversion, which is basically walking out of the state of California when they retire and paying California 9.3%, moving to sunny Florida, a cheaper cost of living, and getting rid of the 9.3% California income tax rate.
Another example of how effective planning enables you to achieve your retirement goals. Coming up next, Dr. David Bush, who is Doctor of Radiation Oncology at Loma Linda University, and the expansion of proton beam therapy into areas other than prostate cancer. All of that coming up next as Lifetime Income continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
According to the American Cancer Society, about 1 in 8 women will develop invasive breast cancer over the course of their lifetime. In 2015, an estimated nearly 232,000 women had cases of breast cancer. Joining me on the program is Dr. David Bush. He's chairman of the Department of Radiation at Loma Linda University Medical Center. Doctor, those are some big statistics. It seems like next to things like lung cancer, breast cancer, and prostate cancer seem to be the two big cancers that affect men and women. What can you tell us about this? And is there any hope in terms of reducing those numbers or perhaps learning more about the cause?
Sure. Well, those are the two most commonly diagnosed cancers by gender, and that's largely due to the incidence of those two being high, as well as there being well-established screening programs to detect cancer in an early stage for both breast and prostate cancer. So we end up treating a lot of these patients and leading to the large numbers that you mentioned.
Now, one theory is that, at least when it comes to breast cancer with women, that a lot of this was as a result of hormone replacement therapy, or HRT. And as that has been reduced, there's been less incidence of cancer. Is there any truth to that research, or have you found anything that supports that?
Yeah, perhaps a partial truth. You know, like most cancers, breast cancer is quite complex in terms of its etiology. There isn't just one thing that causes it. There are a number of things, diet, lifestyle, genetic predisposition, hormone exposure, and many other things that can lead to it. So correcting one of them is likely to make a small improvement, but by itself won't solve the problem.
Now, I know in the past, typical treatments for diagnosis of breast cancer has been surgery followed by either chemotherapy or radiation. We have a client right now. She went through surgery and is being treated with chemotherapy. What are the different protocols for the treatment of breast cancer?
It's quite standard to start with surgery in most cases. There are occasions when the disease is more progressed where they may elect to initiate chemotherapy before surgery. But the sequence you mentioned is still quite standard for most cases. Surgery followed by systemic therapy if needed, and then radiotherapy to the breast or chest wall. And of course, there are variations in that depending on the findings at the time of surgery and the type of tumor. So that's a standard procedure that you mentioned.
Now, your treatment at Loma Linda is somewhat different. Usually, you would begin treatment, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, you would begin through proton beam radiation therapy rather than going directly to, let's say, surgery first.
No, that's not quite so. In the population that we've treated, still initiated with surgery where they did at least a local excision of the tumor. So, you know, it really has not replaced the need for surgery. That's still believed to be a needed and valuable initial treatment. That's where the diagnosis gets established. We find out details on how large the tumor is, how aggressive it might be. Often we find out if there's extension into lymph nodes. You know, each one of these factors kind of need to be known prior to delivering additional treatment with radiation or chemo, because those findings will affect the decisions that are made for subsequent treatment. So in what we have done at our center with proton beam, still included surgery as the first step.
Why the difference with breast cancer versus prostate cancer? Because I know at Loma Linda, proton beam radiation is a protocol used to replace surgery. In other words, if you treat somebody with proton beam therapy for, let's say, prostate cancer, usually the individual does not have to have surgery prior to that. Why the difference with breast cancer?
Yeah, right. So that is a big difference. And you're right. In the case of prostate cancer, there are kind of choices of initial treatment. As you mentioned, either surgery or radiation seem to be equally effective at eradicating the disease. So in that disease, there's a choice between the two, and usually you're not doing both. In fact, you try to avoid doing both. In the case of breast cancer, however, radiation really has not been shown to be a replacement for surgery, meaning that outcomes are better if surgery is a part of the treatment plan. And that's, of course, the case for lots of other cancers, and it's still the case for breast cancer as well. And I think it's because I think one important difference, if we kind of compare breast to prostate, is kind of the ease of removal of the tumor, right? So if you have a small tumor in the breast, they're actually quite easily and readily removed without a lot of side effects or toxicity associated with it. The case with prostate cancer is quite different because the prostate's kind of buried in the middle of your body. It is technically difficult to remove, so there can be a fair number of complications that follow that kind of surgery. So I don't know that anyone's really in a big rush to eliminate surgery for breast cancer because it's a reasonably easy, simple thing to do.
What is the advantage of proton beam radiation when it comes to breast cancer? Let's say it begins with surgery, and then afterwards there's either general radiation and chemotherapy, or maybe a combination of both, to arrest the disease and to basically eliminate the risk of that disease returning. Where does, let's say, proton beam radiation distinguish itself from the other forms or treatments, and what has been the success rate?
The role of proton beam in breast cancer, I mean, this is still something that is still developing for sure, but the role of proton radiation compared to standard radiation is almost always in avoidance of normal tissue, meaning we always want to radiate the part of the body that needs to be radiated and little or none of the healthy tissue around it. And that's what proton beam allows. That is basically always better than standard radiation with X-ray type treatment. So in the case of breast cancer, you know, when we're radiating the breast, kind of the structures and organs that are nearby that need to be paid attention to, you know, one is the breast tissue itself. We know that the more breast tissue that gets radiated, it seems to lead to worse cosmetic results, which is one of the goals of treatment, is to try to leave the patient with a body that is unchanged. Secondly, you know, tissues deep to the breast, the chest wall and ribs, lung tissue, and for tumors on the left side, the heart, each one of those organs and structures can be negatively affected by radiation, by causing things like scarring of the lung, fractures of the ribs, or even coronary artery disease. And of course, none of those structures really need to be radiated. They just kind of get in the way. And we find that when we do treatment with proton beam, we can nicely avoid each of those things. So that's why we use it. That's why we like it. And we've got some data now that supports its use.
Now, is this a relatively new form of treatment? I know Loma Linda has been treating prostate cancer and other forms of cancer for decades now. And proton beam radiation was invented at Loma Linda. But as in terms of its application to breast cancer, is this something new that you've initiated recently, or have you been treating breast cancer for some time now?
When we started treating breast cancer, that was back in 2004, and that was done on a research trial, a clinical trial that was initiated back then. So we've been doing it since that time. We've completed the original trial that included 100 subjects, and then began a second trial that enrolled an additional 150 subjects. That's also completed. And based on the results that we've got, we've been offering that treatment as standard treatment today. So that's kind of how it's gone in breast cancer. I believe that we were the kind of first center to begin using it in breast cancer. But of course, proton therapy predates the 2004 date by quite a bit, you know, back to even to the 1950s, I believe, is when people began doing such things.
Now, I know proton beam, it's been used for tumors of the brain, even liver cancer. Are you finding this treatment protocol applies across, let's say, a wider spectrum of cancers today? In other words, you're finding more uses of proton beam to fight cancer as a therapy.
Sure, you're right. No question. As you can imagine, the rationale for using it in breast cancer, you know, in terms of avoiding healthy tissues, you know, that rationale applies basically anywhere in the body. Certainly, there are certain situations where that will be more valuable than others. But, you know, each one of the sites you mentioned are absolutely candidates for this kind of treatment. Now, the trick, of course, is actually having data that demonstrates it, right? So a lot of people will want to say, well, you know, to apply proton beam to kind of every tumor in the body, which we can come up with a theoretic rationale to do so, insurers and other physicians will want data to prove it, which, of course, takes quite a lot of time to develop. You know, as I mentioned, in the case of breast cancer, we initiated that in 2004. So that takes a lot of manpower. You know, back a decade ago, there were very few centers around, so producing data was slow. Today, with there being more centers and more patient access to it. Data is, of course, more forthcoming. And there are studies coming from our center and many others that are coming out much more frequently now. So that's all work that is currently happening.
Doctor, what has been the success rate of using proton beam to treat breast cancer?
That can be a tricky question to answer because people define success in a lot of different ways. The most frequent circumstance we use radiation for breast cancer is to prevent a recurrence in the breast, right? That is the kind of primary endpoint for radiation. That's what we're trying to do. So in the study that we completed and reported on, we selected patients who had earlier stage disease. So it's important to recognize, you know, any number we might throw at always applies to a selected group of patients. In the patients that qualified for our treatment, the outcomes that we saw in terms of breast cancer recurrence out at 5 years, meaning 5 years from treatment, 97% of patients did not have any recurrence in the breast, which if you go out and compare that to other studies looking at similar populations, that's a good number. You know, whenever you're in the upper 90% of anything with cancer, that's a number to kind of hang on to. So in that respect, the results were quite good. But, you know, really the goal of the trial was to show that we could do this with less toxicity and less side effects and less damage to the breast, so to speak. So those are other endpoints that we feel were just as important as the survival endpoint.
Your point about less toxicity, it's less risky. What is the treatment time? I know that I interviewed one of your specialists there on prostate cancer, and it was like a 9-week regimen, 5 treatments a week. What about breast cancer, the time involved? And you just said it's less risky, there's less toxicity in comparison to, let's say, something like chemotherapy.
Right. So for radiation treatment, you know, in terms of number of treatments that we choose to deliver, I mean, the range goes all the way from one single treatment all the way up to, like in prostate cancer, you know, like a 9-week daily treatment, including all sorts of variations in between. So for the case of breast cancer, since we were electing only to treat the area where the tumor originated at, meaning just the portion of the breast. So we were not treating the entire breast. We were treating a portion of the breast where the tumor originated from. And when we were doing that treatment with proton beam, since we were eliminating exposure to the heart and the lung and the ribs, the need to do these more protracted fractionation schedules really aren't needed. So it allows you to kind of explore using these much shorter treatment schedules. In our case, we chose to do a 2-week schedule, meaning they got one treatment per day over 10 treatments over a 2-week course. So that was just a decision that we made, and that was the program we decided on back in 2004, and we still use it today.
Doctor, what is the acceptance of this kind of treatment? Is it covered, for example, by Medicare or, let's say, most general insurance? Because I know sometimes proton beam can be more expensive. I know in the treatment of prostate cancer, it's a little bit more expensive, and sometimes some insurance companies will not cover it.
That's true. You know, we run into that when there are private insurers primarily. Medicare doesn't really distinguish the method or type of radiation. So for patients with that type of insurance, there are usually few problems. Private insurances do, however, as you mentioned, because of some increased cost, you know, try to limit its use for obvious reasons on their part. So we do run into that with breast cancer. You know, even though we have good data to support its use, there are some insurers that won't cover it, which is actually interesting because, you know, if you do standard radiation for breast cancer, that is typically a 6-week treatment. If you compare that to a 2-week treatment with proton beam, actually the cost of proton is quite competitive and in some cases even less expensive than 6 weeks of standard treatment like IMRT. And there was a study done by the Boston Group that actually demonstrates this. but it can be a struggle to get private insurers on board with the idea.
Doctor, let's say for the women that are listening to this program that are out there, let's say they've been diagnosed with early stage breast cancer. Should they want to consider proton beam radiation? Is this something they should be discussing with their surgeon, their general doctor? How does this all work in conjunction with, let's say, surgery?
So if a woman with breast cancer, you know, newly diagnosed, is interested in perhaps receiving proton therapy, the best thing to do is to contact a treatment center, because each treatment center kind of has different criteria of how they would manage a case like this, ours being the same. And there are certain aspects to surgery that have to be done a particular way such that proton radiation can be an option. Primarily, that includes the placement of some fiducial markers around the area where the tumor was removed from so that we can accurately localize the area after the surgery. That kind of information can be given to patients up front, but usually I think the best step is to contact a proton treatment center.
And then maybe once that contact is made, then let's say that center would then work with the surgeons. So the surgeons, as you mentioned, if they're removing the tumor, they have to leave some kind of markers so you can dial in the area that needs to be treated. So I assume that you have a good relationship with the surgeons, and those performing the surgery understand what's needed to be done.
Exactly. So, you know, we've done that many times. You know, some surgeons will place these markers as a routine procedure, but not all of them do. But there just would need to be an understanding that that is kind of a necessary step if there's going to be proton treatment used afterwards. So it's usually a pretty simple matter. The surgeon would just need to be aware. Those aren't special devices. Those are kind of standard devices, these markers.
Doctor, if our listeners would like to find out more about proton beam radiation and the treatment of breast cancer, are there studies or are there places that they can go to read up and find out more about the results or the treatment itself?
Sure. You know, the type of information such as, you know, we've published out of our institution, you know, this is published in medical journals. And of course, these things are kind of written for the medical community. So patients or lay people may not completely understand it all, but there is information on websites. I think each proton center has its own website that is kind of geared more for patients. I think those can be very helpful. We have a good one from our center, but all centers have them. But those are really today the main way to get that information.
I know that in the area of prostate cancer, one of your patients, Bob Marchini, has written a book on how you can beat prostate cancer without surgery. Anybody written something similar for women to read, or are you aware of any books out there that can explain the different forms of treatment, their success rate?
Boy, one that is analogous to Marchini's book, not that I'm aware of. You know, I think the concept in prostate cancer is, of course, a little bit of a different one, where your patients really have to choose between two very different treatment methods, you know, surgery or radiation. So I'm not aware of it for breast cancer. Of course, the circumstances are a little different in that situation. Patients would still be getting surgery, but there would kind of be a choice between standard radiation or proton radiation. But no, the short answer to your question is no, I'm not aware of a comparable book for breast cancer.
In summing up, assuming that, let's say, somebody's been diagnosed with breast cancer and they're considering proton beam radiation, one of the best forms of finding out information is go to an organization that offers proton beam radiation. I know Scripps Clinic has just built a proton beam center here in San Diego, or a center like yourself's, Loma Linda, would be the best way to get more information?
I think so. You know, the thing I guess to remember is not all centers kind of specialize in the same types of treatment, such as at our center, you know, we've got over a decade of experience in breast cancer, but not all newer centers have treated breast cancer in the same way. So it takes a little bit of research to find some of that out, but certainly that would be a good start.
Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. We've been speaking with Dr. David Bush. He's Vice President and Chairman of the Department of Radiation at Loma Linda University Medical Center. If you are looking for places to get information on the treatment of breast cancer with proton beam, Loma Linda is certainly one source. Doctor, thanks so much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure.
You know, it's interesting, Jim. This seems to be opening up a whole new door because a friend of mine at church was announced to me, oh, this must have been about 9 months ago, that he was going to have his prostate removed because he had prostate cancer. And in my typical tactful way, I said, whoa, time out. have you looked at proton beam therapy like that? And he looks at me like, well, what's that? Is this akin to tin hat stuff? His wife was really worried about that because when you get into cancer, you immediately have this onrush of all sorts of people recommending, you know, all sorts of cures. And I said, well, no, you need to talk to another friend of mine who just went through this because it was a very good alternative. And he did that. And as a result of that, he went to Loma Linda and had the treatment. And since then, he's been cancer-free. I mean, things, his PSAT levels came down and everything else. So this whole new therapy is a new way to go. As I've said, the way they're really going to ultimately knock cancer out is when they learn to use various markers, genetic or otherwise, that specifically ID only cancer cells. Then it will not care where it is in the body. You'll be able to go and get it.
And that seems to be where we're going with, especially some of the biotech firms are moving in that direction. But at least the advancement of treatment of cancer has come a long, long way from where it was, let's say, 20, 30 years ago. And even the survival rates, I was just reading and doing some research for this interview, that the survival rates for breast cancer has gone up. And a lot of it had to do with some studies on hormone therapy, the reduction of that. So who knows where we're going to be going here in the next 20, 15 years. But, you know, one of the key things here is regular checkups with your doctor and not allowing the disease to progress. And two of my favorite authors, Tom Clancy and Vince Flynn, wrote geopolitical novels, Vince Flynn dying of prostate cancer at age 44. And when he was writing his last couple of books, he had a hard time sitting down in a chair because of the pain. And unfortunately, by the time he decided to do something about it, it was too late stage. Likewise with Tom Clancy, both authors dying of prostate cancer within 6 weeks of each other. So the key is early detection.
No, we know it was a government hit. You know that. They didn't like what these guys were writing about.
Yeah, they didn't like the books, and so somebody from NSA got to them. Okay. Well, anyway, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.